If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss. If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
So, very interesting thing came out of the controversy over the BBC chairman, who, of course, has since announced he'll be stepping down, or past the last BBC chairman. He said that he found out about the job through the mailing list that goes to senior Tory donors.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Behind the Lines. I'm Arthur Snell. In mid-March, I recorded an episode with Peter Gagan, who's an investigative journalist specialising in political financing. I got an enormous response to that episode and I wanted to dig deeper into these questions, so there was no one better to talk to than Seth Tavos. Seth has worked with Peter and is also a something of a specialist in the way that politics in this country is financed, but specifically, given that we're just about to have local elections in the UK, and inevitably we'll see a general election at some point this year, or perhaps very early in 2025, I wanted to talk about how political parties finance their activities. So here's Seth on that rather knotty subject. I hope you find it interesting.
Hello, I'm Seth Tavel, investigative journalist and historian.
Fantastic. Well, Seth, great to have you with us. We are recording this in the aftermath of a particularly grotty sort of Tory scandal, which was the racist remarks made by Frank Hester, who had donated 15 million quid to the Tory party, and the odd situation where that party couldn't decide if he was racist or not, and then certainly couldn't decide that they should return his money. But what's interesting to me about this is that £15 million is a huge sum of money by British political standards, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, it makes him technically one of the largest donors, if not the largest donor in history. I think the largest single donation previously was £8 million by Lord Sainsbury in one go, although Sainsbury has given more than 15 in, you know, over about a decade.
Yeah.
What's really important here is the dependence of the parties on a relatively small number of donors. Yeah. There's a fairly normal rule in fundraising, not just in political fundraising, but across the board, which is known as the 90-10 rule. And that is that about 90% of your income will come from about just 10% of your donors.
Right.
And that's why, you know, everybody likes to have a warm, fuzzy feeling being told, we really value our members, we value your membership fees and contributions, that really helps us. That's not how party funding actually works at all. It barely, you know, covers the cost of mailings and so on. What really covers things are cultivating a small number of rich donors, which is why all the parties have done this. I mean, this is, you know, something that goes back hundreds of years, frankly, as long as parties have existed in the last couple of centuries.
Yeah.
And the degree to which the Conservatives have taken that in overdrive, even by their standards, in the last 15, 20 years is astonishing.
Yeah. So let's talk a bit about the sort of the ground rules. The what are the rules that govern who can donate to political parties in Britain, how they can raise money, how much they have to disclose, that sort of thing.
So there are rules which, interestingly enough, a lot of these were put in place in around 2000, 2001. So until then, you could get overseas money in the UK. In fact, on an amusing digression, the Liberal Democrats treasurer once disclosed that he was cultivating a bunch of English expat businessmen in Hong Kong. None had lived in the UK for decades. And they gave him serious sums of money. And shortly afterwards, there was a major data breach, which resulted in The Independent having leaked to them the list of all of these donors. And they turned out to all be Conservative Party donors. So he went back to them and said, well, give more money to us because the Tories will leak your details, whereas we'll stay completely secret. And that is the sort of merry-go-round that's been going on really for decades and decades. But I mean, in terms of how the restrictions work, there are spending limits in every constituency. That is something that goes back to the 1880s, this idea that you can't spend more than a fairly modest amount in your constituency to try and stop people from buying elections.
And that amount, if I'm not mistaken, is really small. It's like £14,000-£15,000 or something.
Yeah, it's literally set depending on the number of voters and the type of constituency. So it does vary, but there's what's called a long campaign and a short campaign. So the short campaign, which is literally like 5 or 6 weeks of the election, it's more like £7,000 actually. Right. And then there's the larger sum, which can be sort of £10,000 to £20,000 quite easily. But that depends partly on a whole number of other things. But what they did in 2000, when they were sort of overhauling the rules on this, was that they created a new category of spending, which was national spending. Yeah. And the thing about national spending is that they have such a high cap on it. I think it was historically about £25 million nationally, and I think it's been raised to about 35 or thereabouts just recently. No party has ever hit it or even come close to hitting it. Yeah. And the thing about the national spending thing is that you can basically bung as much as you like through creative accounting to being assigned to that. So if you hand out in your constituency a leaflet for your local candidate, and it has a picture of the local candidate in your seat who's not standing anywhere else, you can say, well, that picture on one side of it takes up about 10% of the whole leaflet, so 90% of it is chargeable to the national campaign budget. And that sort of creative accounting is endemic in any contested or target seat. All the parties do it because they see the other parties outspending. And this is the thing about the rules. Everybody's like a ferret in a sack. And as long as somebody else is doing something like this and spending loads of money, the only solution is to spend lots of money yourself.
Yeah.
And when we talk about a sort of arms race in spending, this is a really sort of interesting thing because it's not the case that raising and spending large sums of money in itself will actually win you an election. You can spend vast sums of money and still lose an election. What counts is the difference between the two parties. Right. You know, if there's a disparity of one party spending very little and the other party spending a huge amount, it's that disparity is the point that's exploited. So when you start to have spending limits, where those limits are is really, really important because it almost doesn't matter whether the limits are high or low. If you send the spending limits really, really low, everyone's on an equal footing, just as much as if they were raising huge sums of money. And the odd thing about British politics is that although the national elections were spending huge sums of money, compared to US politics, this is a drop in the ocean.
Oh, yeah. And what's interesting is that the entire budget for all the parties added up for a British general election might get you a Senate campaign in a big state in America.
Even that. I mean, £250,000 will get you into the top tier of Tory donors.
Yeah.
Of which, there are a good sort of 50 plus people who are in that category, but it wouldn't get you more than 5 minutes of a congressman's time.
Right. Yeah. Fascinating. Well, but going back to that, the British situation. So you described this odd kind of division between so-called local funding and national funding and the degree to which those rules are basically meaningless. And I think there was a case where the 2010 election that the Tories had a bus. I think in 2015, the Tories had a bus that went around the country to marginal seats. And obviously, you drive to, sake of argument, Cheltenham, marginal Tory Lib Dem seat. You put a load of activists on the ground. They're obviously specifically campaigning in Cheltenham on a local basis, that they can't be somewhere else on that day. But that was because the bus was organized as a sort of national project.
Yeah.
It counted as national funding.
That was very much taking the mickey on the rules. And there is a problem with actually the rules not necessarily being enforced. Where it gets really tricky is that the rules themselves have been changed quite a bit in recent years. I mean, bear in mind that none of those cases, and there were over two dozen of them, none of them resulted in a successful prosecution.
Yeah.
And it was just simply because, a number of reasons, but very often the police are quite reluctant to wade into anything party political.
Of course.
It's controversial, it risks annoying people, all that kind of stuff. But the changing of the rules in the last few years has been really quite a big deal, which has received relatively little attention. So you see things like, under the guise of increasing spending limits in line with inflation, a 50% increase in some of these spending limits and the 30% increase elsewhere. These are very substantial sums of money. And I mean, I saw it pointed out the other day that the Conservatives would not legally be allowed to spend Hester's money if it hadn't been for the fact that they'd just increased the spending limits.
Right.
And I think what that illustrates is that very often people look at donations and spending as two separate things, as these sort of slightly arcane areas in isolation. No, they are two sides of the same coin.
Yes.
Literally, the only reason you're going around raising so much money is so that you can spend it. A past Tory treasurer has commented that the problem for them is that by the time they've raised any sum of money, they've usually already spent it, if not several times over, and they're constantly playing catch up. And so there's this sort of insatiable thirst to come up with sums of money to, you know, get an advantage. And there has been some success for the Tories on that as well. The last year and a third, so basically since the beginning of 2023, consistently, month on month, the Conservatives are outraising the Labour Party by one third. And that's happening across the board every single month. It's really very, very noticeable. So they've been in election gear, building up a war chest. Again, Hester's donation needs to be seen as part of that. And a very indispensable part of that. And of course, the problem is that you find yourself in a position where these people are unsackable. You can't get rid of your donors in that way.
No. That's fascinating. So you've got a party that in the same period that you've described has been underwater in the polls. I think it's said now the longest period that a major party has been stuck at that level, to the extent that it's very hard, even if you're being ultra cautious, very hard to see how the Tories will win any chance of winning this election. And yet they're still raising more money than any other party. So I suppose one question, and I think a lot of us ask is, we people for whom 50 quid might feel like a big donation, and 15 million is sort of mind-boggling. What Frank Hester can't possibly think that Rishi Sunak, maybe he does think. Does he think that Rishi Sunak is going to be prime minister and that's why it's worth 15 million quid? What is it that he's trying to do?
Well, that raises a very good question. I mean, the only person who can give a substantive answer to that is Frank Hester. But let's look at actually why people donate money to parties. Because what's been really interesting in the last, certainly 15, 20 years for the Tories, again, has been the way that, yes, favours have always been traded to donors. Yes, honours have always happened to be bestowed upon donors. But again, it's gone into overdrive in the last few years in a very noticeable way. I think a big turning point actually was under Boris Johnson's tenure, because Ben Elliott, his old friend, became the co-chairman of the Conservative Party, very much involved himself with donor relations. And Ben Elliott, whose day job was running this high-end concierge agency, quintessentially, you know, and they would literally say, you want to meet the Queen of England? No problem at all. You want to have a tiger flown in for your party? No problem at all. Here's the hefty bill to pay for it.
Yeah.
And party political activity and donor relations started to be run in the same way. Again, they didn't used to book out Blenheim Palace for Tory party fundraisers. They didn't used to book out the Victoria and Albert Museum.
Right.
And so it really is this sort of ultimate experience for the very bored super rich. As a way of doing that, as almost as a sort of novelty. So that's at the more harmless end. But then others might point to other benefits which accrue for Conservative Party donors. So very interesting thing came out of the controversy over the BBC chairman, who, of course, has since announced he'll be stepping down, or past last BBC chairman. He said that he found out about the job through the mailing list that goes to senior Tory donors. There are actually two mailing lists. There's a bog standard one for the sort of, you know, £5,000, £15,000 a year normal tier of Tory donors, of whom there are quite a few, let's put that way, in the thousands, actually. But then when you get to the really big tier, sort of 50,000 and above, that has these very senior public appointments. And these are the things which are certainly available for a public process of recruitment and an appointment.
Yeah.
But the decision is very often signed off by a minister. Tory party donors are tipped off somewhat in advance, sometimes of the public announcement this is going. And, you know, ministers are available for chats and advice on what they're really looking for in the ideal candidate. So you don't necessarily feel that this is a level playing field, unless, of course, you're one of these donors, in which case you think this is a fabulous idea. But, you know, since there are lots of these sorts of things, there's obviously a huge amount of suspicion over COVID contracts and how they were allocated to so many Tory donors. I mean, that's just simply a matter of fact. Obviously, there's the inquiry that's ongoing about that, but we're finding out some extraordinary and mind-boggling things there. And one of the things we found out from the Michelle Monnet case is the degree to which the sort of standard mantra of, oh, well, we were just doing our best in, you know, a very short crisis to come up with things. And, you know, we thought, who do we know that really gets things done? Let's ask our donors. Now, you know, it's up for your listeners to decide whether that's a really good way of running a government.
Yeah.
But that is the culture that's evolved.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So you mentioned just earlier about how, you know, the rules change. So there are things like, you know, the change of the limits, the inflation link. Now, another change which has just come in, if I'm not mistaken, is that long-term overseas, we could call them expats, or we might call them immigrants in you know, immigrants to foreign countries, can now register to vote. Now, that in itself may not be terribly important, but we're back to the Hong Kong businessmen that you described. I mean, these days there might be businessmen in, you know, Dubai or something. You might not have lived in the UK for 20 years. You almost certainly haven't paid tax for that period, but you can now register to vote, and that makes you a permissible donor, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And that's a big deal, because it used to be the case that when you moved abroad, you can carry on voting in the UK for up to 15 years. And then after 15 years, if you didn't move back to the UK, I think it's reasonable to say you're probably not coming back anytime soon, and you drop off the electoral register.
Yeah.
And by the way, you could still get back onto the electoral register if you move back to the UK.
Yes.
But yes, where we are now is literally, not, we don't have taxation without representation. We have representation without taxation. We have people who aren't paying taxes. Many of these people that we're talking about aren't millionaires. They're billionaires in terms of the people who are actually affected. So it puts some very interesting people who dropped off the Conservative Party's fundraising roles back on.
Yeah. And then the other thing about these people is, I mean, you know, Frank Hester's wealth, to take an example, a lot of it comes from NHS contracts. Now, I'm sure he would say that in a public-spirited and professional way, he's supplied services at an agreed price to an essential public body. And I'm genuinely not having claiming to have more knowledge than that. But somebody who's made hundreds of millions of pounds in the Middle East, for example, it is very unlikely that people in this country, including dogged investigators such as yourself, will be well-placed to know what their sort of interests are, what their connections are, and that kind of thing.
No, absolutely. And one of the striking things is how many loopholes persist in the current system.
Yeah.
Even though these have been repeatedly pointed out, I would point you, for example, to the report of the Committee on Standards in Public Life, which came out 2.5 years ago, and pointed to glaring issues with the loopholes in the donation laws that allow foreign donations to still happen anonymously. So theoretically, under British law, you should not have anonymous donations, and you should not have foreign donations. They just aren't permitted, which isn't unusual for, you know, most functioning democracies. But there are a number of things you can do. I mean, firstly, there is the scope where if you're making a personal donation, you can act as a proxy for someone else. Now, that's not allowed under the rules, but it still happens all the time. You know, who are you to say that your spouse or your children shouldn't donate some on your behalf? And there's very little interest in following that up. Even more insidious is the scope for companies to donate, because you can donate an unlimited sum of money to a British political party if you are a UK trading company. Now, if you don't trade in the UK, but you want to set something up to donate some money, it's very simple. You set up a UK branch. Now, you don't need to be trading at a profit. In fact, you might literally just set up the registry name and, you know, rent an office somewhere for £500 in the middle of nowhere and take that as a loss. And even if you are a loss-making company that exists on paper only and has done no trading, but has been set up and registered in that way, you can donate an unlimited amount of money. You then put into that the scope for things, I don't know how familiar your listeners are with our old friends, unincorporated associations.
Well, they might not be. Let's explain that, because when I learned about those, I was staggered, and I, you know, perhaps arrogantly think of myself as reasonably well informed on political political matters. So talk us through a brief 101 on an unincorporated association.
Which has been described in a legal judgment as the most anomalous group of individuals ever brought together under law. Is essentially a group of people who don't register a company, they don't register an entity, but they are, as far as anyone's concerned, that company. So an obvious example would be something like the United and Cecil Club, a conservative donor group. They're a dining society and they raise money. Now, if I want to donate money to the Conservative Party, if I'm donating, I think under the current limits is £1,800 or more, I've got to actually declare that and say I am the donor.
Yeah,
but if I donate £10,000 to the United and Cecil Club, then the United and Cecil Club can then bung over that £10,000 and say, we're not telling you who the original donor of £10,000, a not insubstantial amount, is. There is also, even though there's a rule saying that they have to make sure that they've got checks that these aren't multiples of the same person, there's also nothing to stop them from advancing multiple £10,000 donations. Or it might be, you know, £10,000 from this person's account here and £10,000 from their business account here and from their daughter here and all of this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so it's quite conceivable that somebody is a major donor to the Conservative Party because something like the UNC does donate vast sums of money. And we don't know how many or how few. Now, I actually met the guy who ran the United and Cecil Club a little over a decade ago. We got raucously drunk in a Mayfair bar, and he was sort of openly talking about how they do this. And he was saying that, yes, they hold these sort of dinners that are quite small scale. They don't have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people. And one might ask where all this money comes from.
Yeah. So, I mean, to make a practical case, though, if you and I, this second, say that we've just started an unincorporated association of, you know, underemployed podcasters, that's it, isn't it? We don't have to sort of, you know, hire an office or print stationery.
One of the most egregious cases was a vast sum of this was £465,000 spent during the Brexit referendum.
Yes,
which was donated to the DUP, although actually the money was spent all over the British mainland, but not in Northern Ireland, as far as we can tell. And that was traced back to a sort of eccentric Scottish businessman who, as far as anyone could tell, wasn't terribly successful or affluent. And so, you know, we've never fully understood how he came by £465,000,
no,
why he decided to donate the money in the name of the company. I mean, he's been asked repeatedly and has been quite quiet about that.
And the point is he's under no obligation. So, yes, our unincorporated association of underemployed podcasters, if someone approaches us an hour from now with £500,000, we can then channel that money as we see fit or as we've been asked to, and not have to say who our benefactor was.
Well, theoretically now we would have to declare it if it was all in one go, but if somebody went to the bother to bung it over to us in 50 tranches of £10,000, questions asked,
yeah,
you can send that over.
Extraordinary. Yeah. So that points to another issue, which is, so there are rules, but there is no enforcement of them. So the Electoral Commission is the body that is supposed to sort of superintend this, but it doesn't. Why doesn't it?
I mean, it's worth saying the Electoral Commission has only existed since around 2000, 2001, and it was intended to be this great body modelled on the Electoral Commissions of India and Australia that would oversee every aspect of an election and would have the power to investigate. And one of the problems is that although they have the power to investigate, they have very limited fining powers and penalising powers. Indeed, those have been, you know, significantly curtailed recently. Whenever they do investigate parties, and to be fair to them, they have investigated all the major parties and fined them all, you know, varying amounts over the years, that tends to trigger responses of political bias from all the politicians. I think most politicians in most parties tend to agree the Electoral Commission really needs to be reined in, even though many journalists certainly think that they've been quite lenient on the parties over the years and remarkably incurious. So the Electoral Commission deals on the one hand with the administration side, but they also deal with overseeing the financial side. That said, there's an awful lot that they don't reveal or don't know. You know, there are an awful lot of investigations they don't open. If they find evidence of serious criminal wrongdoing, they can't process the case themselves. All they can do is hand that over to the police.
Yeah.
And the police can then take it forwards, or more likely, they may say,
"Oh,
this is very controversial. We don't want to see anything here."
Yeah.
And they've been seriously curtailed in recent years because one of these recent government reforms was putting them beneath a committee of parliament, which means that they are no longer an independent commission. They now have a sort of mission statement, which they can't stray too far from, and members of the governing party make up the majority of the committee that tells them whether they are or aren't on track. So
yeah.
they can effectively be sort of commanded to, you know, go away from particular inquiry, which is extraordinary.
Yeah.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Which, I mean, if we were in Zimbabwe and we were told that the Electoral Commission is under the thumb of the government of the day, you would say, well, you know, sadly, that's how things work here. But this is a new development. This is Britain becoming less democratic, and it's happening right now in 2024.
The other thing I'd mention about the Electoral Commission's responsibilities is that they also publish the figures. So they actually collate and report on party funding. Now, one thing I've never understood is why it takes them 3 months lag time to do that. And yes, I know they have a smallish staff and a limited capacity, but the way that this works is the parties usually have about a month or so after a donation's received to actually report it. They've got a whole bureaucracy around that. I'm not suggesting anything that would, you know, give a huge burden to the party. They still have a month to report it. But the Electoral Commission can then sit on this for 3 months. Now, the reason I mention this is that the Frank Hester case is a dramatic example of this. When that news came out, we thought he was a donor of £10 million. Turns out they'd taken another £5 million from him. And there was nothing improper in it not having been declared. They had already declared that. However, the way this works, we wouldn't have found out for another 3 months if it hadn't been for a leak.
Yeah, extraordinary. So something you touched on there was about how, you know, all parties, of course, have an interest in being well-funded. All parties have taken money from more and less credible sources. I think that there's a famous Lib Dem donor who ended up being a sort of fugitive, wasn't there?
Michael Brown, yes.
Yes, tell us about Michael Brown.
Michael Brown was like a character from a novel. He was a guy from, you know, a very humble background on a Glasgow council estate who had a gift for blagging and started to tell people that he was an investment fund manager who'd been to Gordonstoun and St Andrews, who knew Prince William and Prince Harry really well and was very well connected. And he started bamboozling a whole number of millionaires and billionaires out of, I think it was about £50 million in total. And he was spending it on things like a large house in Hampstead. He was effectively carrying out a pyramid scheme. And so he was getting more and more investors, and that was paying the so-called dividends of the previous investors, which, you know, is tenable for as long as you keep expanding, but not tenable infinitely. And he said the stupidest mistake he ever made was donating £6 million to the Liberal Democrats, which made him the largest donor in the party's history at that time. And the reason is that it suddenly put him into the public eye. And people saying, who is this guy?
Who is this guy?
There's some background checks on him. That it's actually really, really stupid from a donor's point of view to ever give sizable sums of money to a political party because you become a public figure. And he ended up fleeing to, I'm trying to remember where it was in the Caribbean. But he was living there for about 2 years until he was stupid enough to go to a cash machine and use his credit card, which he hadn't used in 2 years. And immediately they were able to locate him to that cash point.
Silly man.
And he ended up being extradited and serving a jail sentence for fraud, for running off with his clients' money. But yeah, you get all manner of things. And the parties are supposed to vet people just on account of, reputation management. But the incentive is there to say, we really want the money. Come on. It's not our business how this guy makes his money. And all too often, all the parties, I'm afraid, have had some quite embarrassing donors.
Yeah, and in a way, what makes Michael Brown quite unusual is the fact that he was sent to jail.
Yes, well, that's what you get if you support the Liberal Democrats, I suppose. But
And then, if to show that we're definitely an equal opportunities sort of podcast, the Labour have had we shouldn't forget that during the New Labour government, I think Blair was actually questioned under caution at one point, wasn't he?
yes, I mean, this was the cash for honours probe, and particularly cash for peerages, which really overshadowed the last 2 years of Tony Blair's premiership and is the reason why Tony Blair was the first prime minister in some decades to not be given a resignation honours. He was sort of considered to be in disgrace on that. And when the Metropolitan Police discontinued their probe after 1 year, one of the quid pro quos was, stop this sort of thing, please.
So that's interesting because we've heard, obviously, people are rightly disgusted at Liz Truss handing out a load of honours for having been Prime Minister for 10 minutes. And people say, oh, good old Tony Blair didn't do it. But this was because he was under a cloud, not because he was being particularly sort of, what's the word, just sort of just showing a higher level of ethical purity.
Yeah, and one of the institutions that has been a bit more bold in recent years is what's called the House of Lords Appointments Commission. That's another sort of Blair era creation from 2001. And initially, they used to say, in the first decade or so, we don't really feel it's our place to try and block people. They've become a lot more aggressive about that recently, partly because they're so annoyed about a couple of cases. One is that of Peter Cruddas, who it's a long and complicated legal case, but he was accused by the Sunday Times of cash for access. He initially successfully sued them for libel, and then it was partially undone, and a judge said that he blatantly did what he was alleged to have done in the central allegation. The House of Lords Appointments Commission tried to block his appointments because he was a pal of Boris Johnson's, who donated vast sums to the Conservative Party and indeed gave £500,000 more a few days after he became a lord. But anyway, Boris Johnson became the first prime minister to just ignore what the commission said and said, I'm going to appoint him anyway, and sort of stretch those powers to the limit. The other one was his good friend Alexander Lebedev. And it's still a little bit blurry as to what happened there, because yes, we understand that they did try to oppose his nomination, but at the same time, I am actually responsible for more FOIs to the House of Lords Appointments Commission than anyone else in its history.
Good for
And
you.
from the sort of pleasant back and forth I have with them, I gather that they have no record on file of any of their objections to Lebedev, which is unlike all of the other donors, where they do keep records. And they say, we have a person matching this demographic description of this party donor, of this party affiliation. There is no crossbench or unaffiliated peer who has ever been opposed by them in their records at the moment, even though people who were there at the time say, we had objections and they were overruled. So
Well,
something very interesting happened there.
that's very interesting, not least because we're also led to believe, according to credible reports, that objections were raised from MI5, possibly MI6, certainly from the sort of security and intelligence world.
And were echoed by the commissioners themselves. It's not like some low-level staffer had passed them a memo. It's that the commissioners themselves were very exercised about this and corresponded with the Prime Minister on this. But apparently there's no record of that in their existing correspondence for some reason.
How very bamboozling. But going back to the Blair case, what this reminds us is that all political parties have this need for money, and of course sometimes politicians use that as the defense. Politics is expensive, we need the money, and so on. But let's talk about the coming election, because you mentioned much earlier that that the Tories have built up a huge fighting fund, and that having the difference between the best and the sort of worst funded campaign is the important thing. So I suppose at top level, is roughly what will the Tories spend on the general election this year?
I don't see any way that they spend less than £70 million on the next general election.
70.
Yeah.
Right. And
I can show you a graph of how much they raise and spend on individual things year on year. The last general election they spent £56 million on, at least.
And out of interest then, you know, so they spent 56, that's 2019.
These are lowball figures.
Yes. What was Labour spending?
I'd have to double check, but I think it was about 30 million or thereabouts.
Right.
Labour have had a bit more money come back because they've always had the trade union money.
Yes. But
big business money went during the Corbyn years. It's now back, but it doesn't begin to compare with the big money that the Tories have, not least because they have so many billionaires amongst their donors who frankly could, out of their petty cash, write them out the largest donations in British political history, which may yet come. We don't know.
Yeah. But I suppose then the question is, I mean, if you are, because it comes back to what does Frank Hester or anyone else want? If you've been 20 points behind in the polls for 2 years, now I'm not one of these people that says that a massive landslide is an inevitability, because of course there are lots of factors, not the least the electoral system, the way the votes fall, undecided voters returning to Tories. You know, many things can happen, but. With all of that, I suppose the question would be, well, what do you do? Let's say you have 30 million quid more than the other side and you want to spend it. What can you do that makes a difference?
Okay, so two things I'd point to. One is I should caveat this by saying that even with a 30 million-ish spending limit nationally, there is an entirely legal way under our system of spending £70 million.
Right.
You can do clever things with accounting periods. So, for example, if you were to hand out, you know, X amount of leaflets going right up to the spending limit, who's to prove how many of those leaflets were printed during the election as opposed to just before the election? And there's a lot that you can sort of pre-prepare. But there's if people do stuff at the last minute, there's nothing to prove or disprove when this stuff was done.
Yeah. So if for example... Because obviously the one advantage the Tories have is they know when the election is. I mean, you know, certainly some of them know. So let's say you know you're calling it in October and you know the timing of the campaign. Is it correct to say then that you could spend a lot of money which isn't part of the campaign ahead of time?
Loads of stuff in September, yeah.
Yeah, and pile up leaflets and other things that cost money and you have to pay for them at some point.
Absolutely.
Right.
But the other way I'd point to getting bang for your buck is really focusing on smaller amounts on individual election races. And what I mean by that is that if you give £50,000 to the Conservatives, there are going to be at least 400 to 500 other people just like you. You're one of many people. But if you give £6,000 to your local Tory MP, you are somebody. You are one of the main donors in their area. And you have a hotline to an MP or possible minister or cabinet minister who will always pick up the phone to you for that £6,000. So a lot of the cannier donors, as well as being, you know, giving £50,000 to be in the big boys club, they will also give lots and lots of small amounts, £2,000 here, £6,000 there, all divvied up amongst key target seats. Or, you know, why is Michael Gove in the ultra-safe seat of Surrey Heath so popular with donors? Because I don't think Surrey Heath is a terribly well-contested seat, but I do reckon a lot of people want to speak to Michael Gove. They might just think he's a very affable man who's good to talk to. But, you know, you get more bang for your buck in terms of a personal relationship. But you could also argue that you get more by way of an effective result. You know, and this is why certain party figures, certainly the chief whip and the party chairman, are very important in doling out money to key seats and deciding what is a key seat.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I suppose it's this thing that you've got, you can spend your money, one, to get invited to the sort of the major events in Westminster, but also you can basically own an MP or two dotted around the place.
You can have a sort of hotline guaranteed to an MP. They'll always take your call.
Yeah, yeah. we've got this sort of scenario where it's pretty obvious that one party has the lion's share of the money and certainly has the sort of billionaires on speed dial. Now, again, it may or may not be enough to sort of shift the dial in an election. Is there a party that doesn't do this? I mean, is there an example of a party that sort of steered clear of dodgy money or just didn't have very much money?
It's very hard to place. I mean, I say the Greens and Plaid Cymru don't have very much money. So yeah. This just doesn't arise very much. But even then, you know, Caroline Lucas was slapped on the wrists by the Parliamentary Commission for Standards because she was, rather her constituency office was auctioning off guided tours for donations. These are tours of Parliament. So, you know, that's pretty small scale, low level stuff.
Yeah.
But it shows that everybody bends over backwards to raise some money here and there.
Yeah.
You know, we used to say that the SNP were so small that they certainly wouldn't be dirtying themselves with money. But actually, the police probe into the SNP in the last few years and their finance has been extraordinary. You know, all this stuff about the luxury camper van
being bought
on party funds and all these things. So it's very hard to see when people are raising those sorts of sums of money, anyone not being touched by it. And again, yeah. I would support what you said regarding Labour. They were pretty bad in office on a lot of this, I'm afraid, the last time around. You know, I realised that was a long time ago, but any incoming new Labour government would really need to clean up its act on that, because Blair came in promising that he would be whiter than white and, you know, end the Tory sleaze and have a totally different culture. And the first scandal that hits his government less than a year into their being in office is the Bernie Eccleston thing of the man who's donated £1 million as the Formula One tycoon now finds that Formula One is the only sport that's been exempted from a ban on tobacco advertising that the government brings in at the time.
Yeah. So then what's the answer to this? Because, you know, elections cost money. And on one level, as we said at the outset, you know, you could be rather happy that our elections are frankly dirt cheap compared to the hundreds of millions that get spent, or even billions that get spent in the US.
Yeah.
Are there things that could make it harder for this to happen?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you ask any politician about something thorny like the state funding of political parties, they'll tell you, well, one thing we can all agree on: no voter wants the state funding of political parties. They hate the idea of this being, you know, charged to the taxpayer. Mm. Well, actually, I don't think that's true at all. Not only because, as you say, British politics is dirt cheap, but we already have a fairly substantial portion of taxpayers' money in this country going to funding political parties. Just no one notices.
Yes.
You know, we have short money and Cranbourne money that funds the opposition in both the House of Commons and the House of Lords. We have similar sort of schemes for all the parties in the Scottish Parliament and the Welsh Assembly. These are millions and millions of pounds. And actually, there's a very reasonable argument to be made that you can sort of cap donations so that they are not only very, very low, but don't exceed the short and Cranbourne money. And this is the point at which I get really, really right-wing. And I start to say, just learn to pay for yourselves, for goodness sake.
Right.
You know, learn to live within your means and actually don't spend money you don't have. And I think actually a government grant set by a formula that roughly tallies with a party's vote share in the last election sort of puts you in tranches so that the main two parties would get about the same and the smaller parties would get a ratio that's sort of, you know, a reasonable proportion, half of that or a third of that. I tell you what, most people wouldn't even notice. And it's less money than is spent on the administration of some government departments. It would be a drop in the ocean.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you're right in the sense that if, obviously, like all these things, how you ask the question. If you say to someone, you know, as they're trying to make ends meet, would you like your taxpayer money to go to fund politicians' campaigns? So, you know, we already know the answer to that. But if you say, would you agree that an infinitesimally small proportion of government money should ensure that politics is transparent and not in the pockets of, you know?
Well, the best question is, are you troubled by the domination of a small number of donors
who
dominate party funding? Do you want to put a stop to this? Do you want to put up this pittance to stop that from happening?
Yes, you're sort of half a pence of your pound of tax or something. But I suppose if I was, you know, giving the counter argument is, okay, let's say we take your we take your proposition and the parties get a grant and maybe it relates to the size of their vote of the previous election or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, in America, you have these super PACs, which effectively pretend to be independent entities that, you know, aren't political parties and, you know, and they're basically just fronts to shove even more cash towards the parties in question. So one could, you know, the ingenuity with which politicians have come up with ways to get around these rules, you can assume that there'd be quite a lot of that happening.
Oh, totally. And what we've seen over the last few decades is a system that's evolved purely by politicians trying to push the envelope constantly.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean you can't do something about it. And super PACs is a really interesting thing because that came about really from a Supreme Court decision. Previously, yeah, that had actually been illegal under the campaign finance measures that were in place from about 2000 to around 2010. And it's the Supreme Court decision which led the way to saying, okay, we're fine for these, you know, large, anonymous, unfunded, almost as anonymous as the unincorporated associations.
Yeah.
You know, there's something of a parallel between the two.
Yeah. And I suppose that there's, a, you know, this is a Supreme Court, the majority of the judges appointed under conservative, Republican administrations. And so you have that kind of, the sort of mentality that perhaps is very comfortable with the idea of billionaires having a big say in politics.
And the parallel here is that the Electoral Commission has said they want to close the loopholes in the electoral law. They've identified this. They've asked the government for legislation to do this.
Yeah.
And the Committee on Standards in Public Life have asked to do this and have said it's a risk of Russian and Chinese and money from other overseas actors who are not necessarily people who wish as well, going into British politics.
Yeah.
And this has been something which the government has just sat on for about 3 years.
Is there a final question? Is that, you know, yes, all parties do this. And of course, part of it is, you know, you have to fight the election on the rules that you've got. And if I was going to sort of give a little bit of wriggle room to opposition parties, I'm talking about all of them, not just Labour, obviously, then at the moment, these parties are dealing with the current setting. But are there any proposals coming out of Labour or other sort of suggestions that would clean up this system?
No, and that's very noticeable. But that's partly because there's been a sort of information blackout as to Labour's policies. You know, they're going into the election with as few things as possible. It is something I find quite objectionable, not just about Labour, but about the political process in general, which is that we've become so afraid of having policy ideas attacked and vilified that the current idea of democracy, it does seem to be that we basically remain completely quiet for about 4.5 years without any policies whatsoever. And then the government publishes a manifesto about 3 weeks out from an election. They have a policy. People are meant to be aware of all of those policies for the ensuing 3 weeks. And then we don't have any other policies for the next 4.5 years and can do anything we like. And that is not a mandate, but that is the set of that is a rule of engagement that they're going by. So I would hope that they are looking seriously at constitutional reform. I think most Labour politicians will be keenly aware at how hard done by they've been over the last few years, but they'll need to be very careful that this isn't just a sort of tit for tat thing, as it seems.
Well, on that point, obviously it just remains for us to sort of see how this situation unfolds, and certainly the rather terrifying prospect of a £70 million election campaign. But Seth, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thank you, Arthur.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Behind the Lines. It was produced and presented by me, Arthur Snell, and the theme tune is by Matty Benbrook. If you want to make sure you never miss another episode, why not subscribe? Thank you. Goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itsinas.
Kayla Itsinas. I'm Kayla Itsinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.